I'm gonna get the recording started here. We already got it. Okay, well, good morning. Welcome to meeting six. Today we're talking chapter 7 of Finding Classroom Engaging Minds. My name is Ben Kern, part of Engaging Educators. You can follow us on Twitter at Engaging Ed or check us out at engagingeducators.com. I'm very excited to be talking about Chapter 7 today, and hopefully we'll get some folks to join us. Make sure as you come in to check your audio settings there from the tools menu. We'd love to hear from you. Excuse me. Today, we've got an important chapter. I'm talking about choice in the classroom, and what I'd really like to do is really focus in on how we can get more choice in the classroom and ways that we can make that happen. There are a slew of great ideas in this chapter for how to do it, and our discussion hopefully will help us process that. Again, I continue to be amazed by the book club, so I want to thank everybody, and I also want to encourage everybody to contribute on the mic and to join in the discussion. I think I'm figuring out that, you know, the more we talk about these things and process them sort of out loud and together, the easier things are to understand, and the easier it is to make these changes in our classrooms. I know Julie is here this morning, and so I'm going to maybe pass it over to her for a little opening thoughts on choice. And we did miss you last week, Julie. Glad you're back.
And good evening. It's 6 p.m. here in Beijing, China. That's pretty early where you are up in the States. And I know Michael is in the room. Thanks, Michael, for coming in. He's eating his dinner. So he's about the same time as me, up the country, Michael, in Perth, Australia. So great to be here and to talk about Chapter 7, which is choice. And this is Step 5 of our 7 steps to flatten your classroom. And this, of course, is about giving students a choice, basically, giving students an opportunity to learn according to how they want to learn, to have different choices for showing what they've learned. And this sort of relates to the way that we run some of our projects, where students, you know, some of the outcomes are text-based, some are multimedia-based. We also have opportunities for students to present verbally or visually, and to raise student engagement and to run the 21st century classroom. Choice is so important. And welcome to Carol, who's from Melbourne, my hometown. Welcome, Carol. Excellent. And here's Vicky, and I'm so pleased Vicky has arrived, because this chapter is in fact one of Vicky's fortes. So I'm doing a mock introduction here, but I'm sure Vicky, you'd like to take over and really give a good introduction to the chapter of choice. Good to see you. Over to you.
Hi everyone, can you hear me? Let me know if you can. I didn't get to do a mic check. I'm just running 6 a.m. in the morning here, as for many of you guys. This chapter is really about differentiation. It's about reaching Every single student, which is a passion of mine, I have three kids, and two of them have what I like to call learning differences, not disabilities, but differences, because our learning lab instructor says that learning disabilities are born in the age in which you live, that in the age of Socrates, if you couldn't memorize it, if you were not an auditory learner, you would be put in a slow class. Nowadays, those auditory learners have a lot harder time because we force them to take notes, which in some ways has them break eye contact and makes it harder for them to learn. So for this chapter, of course, Julie and I wrote everything together, but I have a presentation I do called Technology-Driven Differentiated Instruction. And I saw at the conferences that every single time I gave this presentation that the room was completely, absolutely full, that teachers are passionate about trying to reach every single student, and they want to know how, and they want to know how to do it with technology because they know that technology can make their lives easier, that lecture is just not enough. If you just lecture, you can't reach every single student. We have to get their hands in there, and we have to do things. So this chapter actually transcends just global education into any classroom and how you can reach every student using technology. So it's about giving students choice. It's about having passion-based learning and unleashing their passions. And it's just really, I think out of all the chapters, it's probably one of the most important to me, just because I know that there are some children out there, like my children, and there's some parents out there that want their kids to be reached. And, you know, the difference between business and school, you know, business people all the time say, oh, if I could go in the classroom, I would clean up education. And I say, you know what, I've been in the business world. No, you wouldn't, because the moment you found out you couldn't fire your students, you would leave. Because teachers, we have to teach anything that comes into us. In most schools, we teach every student that comes in the door, and we have to work with what's there. And a great teacher is not one who can just teach the great students. The ones that are going to learn alone in a room with a book by themselves are going to be great students no matter who delivers instructions to them. Our goal is to reach every single student. It's to reach everybody and to unleash their potential and let them leave your classroom knowing that there is something in this world that they are passionate about, that they're good at doing. And I think that can happen in any class, no matter what you teach. So, you can't fire students, Michael. So I'm going to go back over in a bit and let you guys get talking, because I've talked a little too much, and make sure that I've tweeted out to everybody here. Usually these things, we start getting a lot of people as we get started, and they know that we're here rocking along. So I'm going to be tweeting, watching that hashtag Black Class. And thank you again, Ben, for doing such a great job. I look forward to this every week.
Thanks so much, and I know Neil and I do too, and Neil will be back next week for the meeting. It's important, I think, to differentiate learning for teachers when you're teaching teachers too, and when teachers are having conversation before you got in here, Vicki, I was talking about how just talking about all these things that are in this book helps me process it and help it make more sense to me and listening to what other people are saying. So really, really appreciate this sort of novel approach to collaborative learning that we're undertaking here. So it's been fascinating. And as a parent myself, parent of three as well, next year all three will actually be school age. A lot of the things that we talk about, both as engaging educators and as teachers and learners ourselves, it's rooted in a lot of you know, a lot of it comes from being a parent, so I completely understand what you're talking about there. Anyway, I don't want to talk too much either, but I do want to move on to here. But there are several, as you go through the self section of the chapter 7, there's several examples of how to make this happen, this idea of differentiating instruction. And I want to know from the folks who are doing it, what ways work for you? What are you using PBL? Are you using UDL? Are you taking in to my multiple intelligences? What are you doing to make sure every child is reached? What's that teaching look like? And so we'd love for you to join in and share your ideas. You can raise your hand if you want to add a comment. The raise hand button there is underneath your name in the participants little box over there. But we would be very interested from hearing from teachers on what's working, what you're using. And Michael's asked about PBL. Is there anybody using PBL? We refer to project-based learning, and it's a way of teaching students that involves answering a big question. So a big question is presented to them as a driving question, and the students then are charged with answering that question and working through it, and usually involves creating something, solving a problem often, and it can be a very engaging way of teaching. Anybody want to talk about, definitely in their own way, anybody want to talk about ways that they're differentiating choices that they're providing in terms of instruction in their classroom? I'd like to hear from folks. And I think it does become clear that there is a huge importance on this idea of choice and letting students make those decisions, and how empowering that can be for a student, probably most of us in our educational experiences were not given a whole lot of choices, and I can only imagine how much better that would make things. Vicki had a comment here. Go ahead.
So I'm going to talk about something that's not in the book, that is a newer thing. We're calling it the Freshman Project. I'm going to rename it next year, but it's a year-long project in my ninth grade computer fundamentals class, which just so happens to have some juniors and some seniors and that sort of thing in there. But it is based on the Google 20%. We're taking 20% of our time in that class, so basically one day a week. Most every week it's Friday, but right now, this last 2 weeks, it's due this Friday. We're taking the whole time, and each student designed a project last fall that they would want to spend 20% of their time on. And I'm going to grab a couple of links here and share this with you in the chat on our Westwood Wiki. They're still kind of forming and turning those in. But it's just been incredible. It's based on the Google 20% time. Google allows their employees to spend 20% of their time on a project of interest to the students. And you can see that my students have sort of built their wiki here. And I want to share one in particular from Rhea. Rhea's dad is a doctor, and she wants to be a doctor, and so her project is called MedTech for Tots, and she's made a YouTube channel. She did get permission from her dad to use her full name because she wanted to, and you can see her presentation where she's embedded a YouTube video that summarizes everything that she's done. She's built a website, And she's gone through all of the equipment in the office, and her goal was to make it so that it wouldn't be scary for children, because her dad is a pediatrician. She wants to be a pediatrician. And her dad actually talked to me. It's kind of funny. Her little brother, Mitt, if you've ever seen the Muppets and you have Beaker and then scientist, the mad scientist there, you know, Beaker kind of sits there and he gets experimented on, and her little brother Mitt's kind of like the Beaker in some of these bits. It's so funny. You know, now I'm going to take Mitt's blood pressure. But her dad says that she's really spent an incredible amount of time understanding the profession and what he's doing with the different equipment, and how meaningful it's been to him and to her to do this. So it's just been a very powerful project for me to see what can kids do. Now, my biggest struggle has been the 10% of students that have not done their work, haven't really jumped in, haven't really done what they set out to do, and really working with those kids and communicating with those parents, because the parents of these kids that don't do the work would rather have a worksheet and have the kids just not turn in and take a zero a couple times a week, because these kids tend to be procrastinators. But I think it's getting them ready for the business world, where you do have to do work and you do have things. So this is an example of project-based learning. It's a year-long project. I didn't come up with this idea myself. It came from Evansville, Indiana. And they have a senior project, and every student, they have netbooks, and they wanted to get the kids to actually use the netbooks. And they have to have a project that's going to take 100 hours of their time, and saw some phenomenal work from kids of what they were doing with that. So I think that that schools as a whole need to look at how they can integrate project-based learning into the whole curriculum, and can we have year-long projects? I know Julie had some year-long projects in Bangladesh where her kids were creating websites, and one student actually sold his website for quite a bit of money after he got out of high school. So that is a big example of providing choice, because people want to know, okay, if we don't like standardized testing, what should we use instead of that? And so I would say, okay, maybe keep your standardized testing. Don't attest so much through the year, because if you're always weighing the chicken, when do you feed the chicken? Okay, so the chicken is always on the scales. The chicken's never getting fed. So we're hurting classroom instruction. You guys are testing so much. So test once a year. A good result of a test is going to be a good result of a good curriculum. But have a year-long project in every single grade where students can do something like this and have that be part of your assessment as a school and of the student. Okay? That's my thoughts, longer than I planned.
That's great stuff. I mean, some of these projects, when you check out some of these things that kids are doing when they're given the authority and the power to make these decisions, this can be amazing stuff. Pass it over to Honor here. Welcome, Honor.
Hi, everybody. I guess when you were asking earlier about project-based learning, what leapt into my mind is actually the three keywords that we often use to describe the different ways to differentiate. So you can differentiate by product, by process, and by content. And I know for me, and it seems true for many people, that the easiest, so the first one that you might try as a teacher is giving students choice over the product, right? So they're all still learning the same thing in the same way, but then when it comes to the final presentation of what they've learned, you can choose from a few different formats, or maybe you make it a wide open kind of a choice. And so as an English teacher, I used to do that, certainly. And in teaching and writing, there's a pretty cool idea that's been around a long time now called the multi-genre research paper, where instead of writing a traditional paper, as a result of their research, students are creating lots of different genres that speak to their topic from different perspectives. But still, like, you know, that's just one of the three possibilities. And then I feel like, for me, the next easiest one is content. And obviously, this could be, again, a limited range of choices or completely wide open. So rather than prescribing all students will research this one particular topic, then they would have a choice of topics, or they would be encouraged to find their own topic within the sort of, you know, the area that you're focusing on in your curriculum, I guess. But I was thinking about how, for example, Heidi Hayes Jacobs encourages people to start there, like I just said. So start by, you know, using Web 2.0 tools to give kids different choices of product, and take advantage of, you know, the fact that there's more content on the internet than, you know, in the traditional curriculum, and for students to choose that. But then I was thinking about how in the flat classroom projects I've been in, part of the magic really happens when students have choice over their process. And so that's the point I want to make, is just that once we equip students with these skills and these tools, then they're able to be really flexible and they figure out their own, you know, their own workflow. And it might be confusing to someone who comes in the room, you know, and they see all the kids are on all of these different platforms doing all these different things, but you as the facilitator of the project know that it's all productive because there's just so many different ways to go about, you know, achieving the collective goals of the project. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think for many people, the process, the choice of process, is the hardest or the most advanced level to get to as a teacher. And I actually feel like, you know, this structure and framework that Julie and Vicki have helped us develop works really well for that. That's what I wanted to share.
Thank you. Really, really just brilliant stuff there. Thank you, Lana. And let me be the first one to charge you with a project of writing a book about that. Please, Lana, thank you. Because I'm telling you, the number one thing that we are asking teachers to do, it seems like, it is to differentiate, and I'm all for that. But when you're sitting in your little feedback meeting with your principal after you got observed, and they're saying, you need to differentiate, you need to differentiate, and no one's telling us how to do that, no one's teaching us how to do that. And if the principal would then follow up with some of those things that Honor was saying, and, you know, or if instructional coaches were there to help us with that, we would be very lucky. We're just not getting that. Let's that's a good point. Let's talk to Michael here. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, guys. Hope you can hear me. I think my internet's going to hold up. Thanks, Julie. It's probably not the good time to admit that the longest I ever taught my own class was 4 weeks. But this is about the only example I can draw upon for this topic. It's been back last year, and we ran the first Global Classroom project when it was just a wonderful time when it was just the six of us. what I was doing with my students is we're contributing to voice freedom culture. For these kids, the very fact that they're using technology was a bit of a shock. If you met their teacher, you'd understand why. But we had kids in that class actually participating because of the different technologies we were using. Some of them were really put off by the voice thread, which I could understand. But the highlight for us was the use of EduGlockster. And what I got the kids to do was to create Glockster on a country of their choice. Now, this was probably the most multicultural class I've ever taught. They spoke about 13 different languages and come from about 9 different countries. So for many of them, they're doing them on their home countries. And for me, what was most significant was the kids who you can hardly get a piece of work out of. You're given a purpose for their learning, and given the technology which actually enabled the learning, for some of them had next to no literacy skills in year 6, you know, kept stringing a few sentences together. I gave them an outlet and gave them the creative freedom, I suppose, to demonstrate their learning. And for me, it really did bring home the power of just giving students a bit of choice in their learning, within the constraints of the environment I was in. But yeah, this is something that I've wanted to share, and I'm going to throw a few links in the chat so you can have a look. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike. I'm going to hand it over to Vicky. Go ahead, Vicky.
And I just wanted to say this whole thing about observing differentiated instruction and what's going on with that. And, you know, it's interesting because my principal and curriculum director have taken to observing me in a different way. Because we do projects and because we do differentiation, pretty much the current observation type methodology really kind of says, okay, are they a great lecturer in many ways? Because you kind of have this traditional view of the teacher in the front of the classroom speaking and being responding and that sort of thing. And certainly there are those teachers that are there. But in my classroom, you know, I got to where I apologized when they walked in my classroom to observe me because it's like, I'm sorry, I'm not doing anything today. The kids are working. I'm sitting here thinking, I am doing something. I'm walking around this room. I'm working my rear end off. I'm helping. I'm coaching. I'm one-on-one spending time with these kids. This is doing something. It's just not the traditional mode of the teacher is the sun and the kids are the planets revolving around the sun. That's not what you do when you do this method. So, you know, that's the struggle with observation is the traditional, I'm going to sit here and watch you for 30 minutes. When you're differentiating, you're not at the front of the classroom being this amazing Robin Williams, carpe diem, stand on the desk, spellbinding speech. You're in there. It's just a very different way. So I think the whole observation method, if you want to observe differentiated instruction, has to really be different than I'm going to come observe you 30 minutes twice a year. God forbid I was in a school where I got observed twice a year and evaluated based on that, because I would say, look at what my students do and evaluate me based on that. And I think it's a much better evaluation is to look at eFolios. In fact, this conversation is going on right now in the U.S. I don't know what you other folks think about this in honor, if you know of any methods of evaluation that really take into account differentiation and that sort of thing. But this is just it's a real issue of if you get what you measure, and we're measuring the wrong thing and the wrong kind of teaching. You know, so they're meeting with you saying you're not differentiating, but they observed you for 30 minutes. And how can you really observe that?
Yeah, that's a great, great point. Go ahead, Julie.
Sure, Ben, I'm taking some notes here, different things I want to say. See how maybe I can get in the next 2 minutes about the microphone. But, you know, listening to Vicky speak in that last comment, actually, you know, this whole idea of a flipped classroom, and in my mind, the jury's a bit out as to whether this is actually an original idea in terms of flipping, or whether it's something that we've always done. I feel like flipped classroom is something I've pretty much done most of my teaching life anyway. It just has a fancy new name. But, you know, allowing students to come to class ready to learn, already backloaded with skills and knowledge that allows them then to be in the classroom that Vicky described. So the teacher is the facilitator, and you are moving around the class and working with different groups of individuals and then allowing them to combine and move away, etc., in their own groupings. I mean, that's what I call a productive classroom environment, and that's where, you know, you can have differentiation of instruction in terms of content. Students are covering different levels of content and different quantities of content. You can also have differentiation in terms of product, as we've already discussed. And I do like the way Anna described the differentiation in process, because I'm thinking of actually a number of things that I often do that's exactly how you would describe it. I just want to talk about a couple of things also. Where I was in a one-to-one laptop school, and one of the ways that we allow differentiation is through the operating system of the laptop. And this is not exactly a popular move. Many teachers are frustrated by this, but we have 40 different nationalities in our school, and you know, nearly 40% of the students are Korean. So even though our IT department are Chinese, we do allow the students from Korea to have their operating system in Korean so that they can actually feel more comfortable working with the technology. And it's a little bit of a learning curve and challenge for us sometimes if we have to try and fix something on the laptop. But I think this is an important part of what we do as a school to individualise instruction and not to, you know, we're an English-speaking school, but we don't mandate that the students have to have all of their operating system and everything in English on their laptop, because it just doesn't work for some of these kids. They have to have their first language. And just my final point, talking about student-led conferences, we run portfolios, student digital portfolios. We use a Wiki platform for that. And just last week, actually, we ran our middle school, which is we ran grade 6 to grade 9, student-led conferences. And if you're familiar with these, you will understand. If you're not, I strongly recommend that you look to implement them in your school, because they are one of the most powerful learning experiences that you will ever see in a school. And to have a student sit with their family, mother, father, whatever, and talk about their learning and show their learning and show how they struggled, how they were challenged, how they succeeded, etc., had fun with multimedia. I mean, that's just an amazing thing to do. Student-led, it's not parent-teacher, no, the teacher's not involved. The teacher says, welcome, go and sit with your child at the table, and the teacher backs right off, okay? Which is really hard for many teachers. We had a number of new teachers at school this year who said, what, we don't talk to the parents? No, the student talks to the parents and shows them their portfolio, walks them around the school, shows them the art department, etc., and the teacher just does nothing except smile. And it's a great experience. Thanks.
Yeah, so we're getting into a lot of these ways that this is happening, and it would be some great conversation, great ideas, whether it's the portfolio learning, which personally I think is something that needs to happen in a lot more schools than it is, or the student-led conferences. These are all amazing ideas. I'd like to know what else works. I mean, I know that we sort of enjoy, in my classroom at least, we sort of enjoy providing kids with these toolkits and allowing them to sort of differentiate on the product side, and giving them choice in the content that they're working on is also good too. And I know there's been a lot of writing on student-centered classrooms and student-directed learning and things like that, so there's good stuff out there. But what about this idea of the environment that the chapter talks about, creating a choice environment? And I know the Ewan McIntosh section there was a little bit sort of hard for me to process, I guess, and maybe we talk about these different kinds of spaces of learning and how you create that environment. So it sounded like this idea of a physical environment and then these ideas of these electronic spaces that Vicki and Julie talked about. Maybe Vicki, you could sort of break down these seven spaces, maybe not necessarily one by one, but maybe just sort of give us an overview of what Mr. McIntosh is talking about there.
Well, you know, schools are not just bricks. They're bricks and clicks. And actually, Ewan and I ran into each other at in South Africa at the Microsoft Partners in Learning conference. We were both there to cover the conference as bloggers. So we had quite a bit of time to converse. So we were actually on this boat heading out to Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned, and we were both in the front of the boat having this good conversation, trying not to get seasick because the boat was really rocking. But it was, we were talking about differentiation and what we're doing with our classroom and the passion there, and he said, it's more than just about giving students choice in the classroom. It's about making the facilities in the school a choice itself. And he started talking about his seven spaces of learning and how you design that. And so this is the physical location as well as your online spaces. It's designing for bricks and clicks. And we tried to pull some examples. Now, St. Cyprian's, these are actually some photos I took when I was in South Africa, because he said, these are some great architectural examples of what it means to give choice. And I'm looking on page 169 for those of you who have your book, and there's a lovely photo of a library, and you see some group couches, and you see some beanbag chairs, and you see lots of different choices of how kids can sit, so that if they're a social type of person, they can sit with others, if they can sit by themselves, if they want to read. So, first he talks about secret spaces, which is, these are private spaces. And these are, whether it's sending text messages or the inflatable igloos that the Salfire Center in Glasgow has, and that particular library doubled its foot traffic when they redid their spaces. So it shouldn't just be chairs and cubicles or chairs around a table, that libraries are actually evolving. And you see the mention in the chapter of the learning commons as well. Are there places to group together? Are there places to publish as a school? Are there places to perform? And this one's really challenged me, and you see this a lot in learning commons, is that libraries are becoming are becoming places where kids perform, and some libraries are opening at 7 a.m. in the morning and having kids come in and perform poetry and perform music and have this outlet. And some are having a break instead of having break outside. The kids are coming in and they're performing and they're bringing in coffee and they have, you know, set it up more like a Starbucks kind of thing, which is what we have here in the U.S., of course. And places to participate and places to, you know, this other one, though, sharing data and making, it's an open data movement. So a school sharing all of their energy data with the students and with the public to kind of help share the burden of trying to come up with innovative ways to save electricity, as well as, you know, this whole watching spaces thing, which is kind of interesting, of having short lectures and making it so you can watch your teachers in other places. And so it's really about the bricks and the clicks and giving students a lot of choices for how to get their schooling. It's a very powerful, insightful piece, and I was glad that he agreed to let it go in the book. And I hope that it shook up everybody, because the traditional design of school is not going to cut it. There are going to be some schools in some counties I could see, I hate to say it, because those that will suffer will be those that are impoverished, because I could see that there may be a time when small counties go completely virtual and don't have face-to-face school and make it all virtual because the neighboring county has provided an excellent education in that way, and they can save more money, and so they're just going to get kids laptops and buy them internet access. So what happens when that happens? You know, it's kind of scary, but just... those are the thoughts. Michael.
Yeah, I know, Neil and I, we teach in Detroit, and such a huge issue here is crumbling schools and troubles that they have. And so you look at these huge school districts helping a large number of kids and just getting left behind, it does become a bit of a concern. And I know it's true for a lot of small school districts across our country, at least. Michael, I was wondering if you'd be able to talk about why that would be hard for it to happen there, and maybe tell us what you see some of the obstacles for some of this being, if you're able to. But we might not be able to get audio on Michael right now, but I do think, you know, that those sorts of things, with changing those kinds of spaces, is huge for students too, and that would be a big way of making it happen. Got behind on my slideshow here, but the last thing I wanted to talk about this morning, or today, sorry, is that there are choices that could increase student engagement, and the idea of, you know, that's what I'm all about, and Neil and I are all about engaging the educators. So we love looking for ways to help teachers make that a reality in the classroom. But what do you see from students when you're giving them choices? I mean, we try to work as much choice in as possible. Even we've gone so far as even, you know, giving kids choices and, you know, do you want to do writing at 9 o'clock, or do you want to do math at 9 o'clock? Those sorts of small choices. But what are we seeing from students when they're given this choice, and a lot of us have been doing this long enough to know what it looks like when we don't give students choices. I'd like to maybe hear about that. Like, what does that do for kids? How does that help them? Who can talk to that?
I'll be in here and just talk about, giving students choice. I just put in the chat there, just fostering that confidence in students and allowing students to show, to show different abilities, or our abilities in different ways, but just being able to allow the freedom in the classroom to support different ways of learning and not being afraid of, and I was with a teacher again the other day, and I'm afraid we all have them in the school who use the term dumbing down, and I hate that term. It really makes me angry, actually, when teachers talk like that, when they think that because you're providing alternatives, that you're actually not doing a service to the students. And, we really need to move away from this. Yes, there are certain exam requirements, testing requirements and exam requirements that perhaps we can't afford at the upper levels, but to actually provide a program for students that perhaps weaves them through some of that and don't make all of the testing compulsory, give them some sort of choices for different assessments, etc. And I do not see that as a dumbing down approach at all. I see that as a viable approach in the 21st century to give each student an individual learning plan and let them see where they can end up if they follow it. Other thoughts from anyone else?
Yes, thank you, Vicky. I'm sorry, thank you, Julie. And I think that this idea of the individualized learning plan or letting kids make those choices about what they want to learn about and how they want to learn about it. So here in America, it's so challenging for us. When we come back to the idea of the standards and the testing, and so I think that becomes a huge obstacle for teachers here, at least, to say, well, we can't make any of these changes because we have tests to pass and things like that. But just when you see the sorts of things you guys are talking about with. What happens with students and what they're able to do and the freedom that they have. I think that's great. Really enjoyed it. And if you do have the book, really enjoyed the figures 7-12 and 7-14 about whether students are ready and also what ways of injecting a little bit of technology into the teaching there for engagement. But I think making giving students these opportunities is huge. Who else can talk about what they see, have seen from students when given the opportunity for choice? Is there anybody else who's able to speak to that? We'd love to hear what that looks like in your classroom. Or if you have any questions at all that you'd like us to talk about, any questions or concerns, I'd love to hear from you. And I think I want to, hoping to avoid too much dead area. Go ahead, give it a try, Michael.
My audio has been playing up the last 10 minutes. I'm hoping this will work. I just want to briefly say that I have very limited experience with actually teaching students in my own class. But what I do know is that if you provide a little bit of choice within the boundaries of the work you're doing, maybe it's the use of technology, maybe it's the ability to give students a choice of technology to present their learning. It just has an incredible impact upon the students. For me, you know, I had a really severely disadvantaged young lady produce a piece of work, probably the only piece of work she produced in an incredibly long time. And the same with the gifted children. You know, the other gifted kid was born out of her brain because of the way she was being taught. But the use of technology gave her a chance to show what she could do.
Thank you. I'm glad we got your audio working. Hopefully it continues here for the last 15 minutes today. I really want to hear from Honor on this one. Go ahead, Honor.
Well, Richard, I have to admit, I drifted away cognitively. So I hope this is connected to what's been talked of recently, but I was in a conversation with some colleagues this past week, and the question of the bring your own device movement came up, and so it just occurs to me that, you know, there's a debate about how, whether that would be a good policy, whether, you know, property is obviously an issue, and so students who don't have a device to bring need to be provided with one. But in terms of choosing the technology and just, you know, in a sense, starting with a device, it seems like it does mirror the real world a little bit more. So one of the concerns that was expressed in one of the arguments against to bring your own device idea was just that it's too challenging for teachers because then students don't all have the exact same platform or the exact same software, and so then that would require teachers to be that much more adaptable. But then I was thinking, well, that's assuming that the teacher is standing and demonstrating exactly how to do every little thing on the technology rather than letting students teach each other or letting them, you know, tinker and figure things out. And granted, you know, again, back to that sort of chaos idea, but I do think that, you know, I have students who don't have a computer at home, but they do have a smartphone, and that's how they connect to the internet, and they're very adept at using it. And you know, if we're flexible enough, and if we just make sure that everyone has some kind of internet connected device, even though it's a little bit more complex, I think it might allow for students to engage in different ways and then come up with more creative solutions to the problems of sometimes not, you know, having everything uniform. And then also I think that's what it's like in the real world. So if you go to a business meeting maybe if you all have, you know, a company issued computer, it's different, but for the most part there is a negotiation around which tool are we going to use, you know, what are people the most comfortable with, what tool would really work for our particular project and our group. And anyway, so I just thought I would raise this topic of bring your own device, see what other people think about it.
Thank you. That it is definitely fits in here, and I haven't really been sure what to think about it. My biggest concern is something that you talked about in the beginning there, this idea that there may be kids who can't afford that. I mean, a lot of us are working with kids whose money is tighter, or folks are out of work, and how do we address that? But you seem to talk about that in a way that is the school would then be able to make up for it, and so that would sort of, level the playing field that way. But imagine that, letting kids figure things out, letting kids tinker and explore. There's your engagement right there. Tina, are you able to comment and to follow up on your comment about how it's hard to add in choice? Because before we wrapped up, I did want to maybe have a small discussion about obstacles. It's just one of the things I don't know if this is necessarily in the book, but it's something that comes to mind because it's as teachers, it's what we're up against is these ideas. There's a lot of things standing in our way in terms of making a lot of these things happen. But Tina mentioned how it's hard to, I'm kind of scrolling the chat there, but it's hard to add in choice with the younger kids. But I was wondering if Tina, are you able to take the mic and follow up on that?
Yes, hello. I teach third grade in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. They want us to be doing more project-based learning, letting the students work on their own level. They're not teaching us how to do it. I know you made a comment about that earlier, giving us the resources in the background to help the teachers do this. But I know, like, the first and the second grade teachers are always saying they need to learn how to read this year. How can I give them choice if I have to teach them their addition facts? I'm teaching multiplication facts. They need to know how to read. Where does this project-based learning, fit in there? And I need to do more research on it myself. But one thing, I always did a project every year where the students had to learn a different historical person, and they dressed up as that person after they researched them, and they would color a picture on a stamp in honor of that person, and they had to design it. Last year I moved to a different school that had more technology, so at the end of the year, since we had our netbooks and we had a lot of Web 2.0 tools that we had used, I gave them the option, do you want to create a project with one of the tools, use VoiceThread, use Globster, go animate, or do you want to do the stamp that I always did? And they really enjoyed having that choice. Nobody picked the paper that we always used in the past. Everybody wanted to do a project, and how much more involved they got, the project came out better. They really understood that person more. So that's just one example where we did give a choice, and I can see the benefits of that. But I'm not sure whether I can do that all year long. And is it okay for the younger grades not to be doing as much? But then when the high school level, now they know everything, now they can be doing, more of project-based learning.
Thank you, Tina. Is there anybody like to answer that question? What your thoughts are on what Tina raises with the working with the younger kids? Anybody want to talk to her or talk to us, I guess you'd say, about that? And if you did want to, just raise your hand, please. My thought, Tina, I teach fifth grade, so not that far removed from where you are, but my thought is that as much as possible you can do that, and looking for ways to incorporate that choice in the ways that you're teaching reading or teaching math facts and things like that. Although when we were talking about project-based learning earlier, I was thinking, you know, one of the big troubles there is the standardized testing. If the choices are rooted in the standards, you know, grounded in the standards, and the teaching is, you know, then the kids are going to excel on the test. We're not talking about, you know, throwing away the standards and going completely rogue here. We're just adding in those elements of choice. And one of the things, too, that I've learned about choice, and this comes from the teaching with love and logic. I'm going to have to try to find that website, but the idea of choice as a management tool, I know this it hasn't really come up, but this idea that students are going to be more focused and more engaged when you give these choices. It's going to lead to a more productive and a more positive classroom environment. And choice as sort of like a management strategy is something that at least I've been taught to about in terms of elementary school. Anybody else able to talk about Tina's concerns or have questions of their own about obstacles? We'd love to hear from you. I think, too, there's other obstacles in terms of, you know, and we have touched on some of them, this idea that you know, a classroom with a lot of choices is a little noisier than a classroom where the teacher's standing up and talking the whole time. The classroom with choices is going to be a little messier. It's going to not look like classrooms that folks are used to. I think these are obstacles too. And then the whole teacher evaluation piece can be a challenge too. We do want to make sure everybody's questions get answered. If there are any other concerns, we'd love to hear from you on the mic. Just grab it and join in. Because we are coming nearer to the end here, and what we want to make sure we do is sort of wrap up with any other topics that you want to bring up. We've had some impressive discussion, and I did want to make sure. I don't think I really helped Tina at all, but Tina, if there were other thoughts you had about your situation with younger students, I'd love to hear some more from you if you're able to, Tina. Okay, well, hopefully we helped. I think what we'll do is we'll wrap things up here. I'd like to get some parting thoughts maybe from Julie or Vicki before we have to wrap things up here. Julie or Vicki, go ahead.
Yeah, this one is a tough one because it speaks to the current evolution of education and where we're moving to a more project-based, engaging environment. We're finding that all of that information that the kids memorize can be easily found on the internet, and so how does that classroom evolve? So this speaks to teacher evaluation systems. It speaks to just about everything, because when you create something, you're moving, you know, to the top of Bloom's taxonomy. You're creating. And you know, the point is, are you differentiating? Are you trying to reach every student? And, you know, we've had a lot of conversation in the back channel in terms of the different views on, you know, whether kids start off as self-directed or not. And to me, they, whatever your view on that is, it doesn't really matter. The question is, are they self-directed by the time you're done with them? Have you inspired? Have you helped students learn? Have you helped them become the kind of passionate, engaged learner that is self-directed? I think that should be the goal of this. And when you have passion-based learning, which Angela Myers talks about, and you have project-based learning, and you have UDL, Universal Design for Learning, and you have differentiation, then you can do that. It is a great vehicle to be able to do that. So I think that's the point I would like to leave. Sometimes it's so easy to get caught up in education theory that we don't apply. And I really, you know, I kind of feel like an engineer. My husband is an engineer. And, you know, the scientists, they get back in their research and they talk about how the world works. And the engineers actually make the world work. And I kind of feel like that with teachers, is that we need research and that sort of thing. And there's a big controversy going on right now because there are a couple of psychological journals that are going to go back for the last 3 years and validate every single research study that was produced in the book, in their journals, to see if they really are accurate. And there's a lot of people very concerned that some things are going to be proved wrong. And so I'm just, you know, I guess talking around the fact that we're still not sure how it's evolved, but we do know that the highly engaged things that are happening are projects. Look at what all of the motivational type educational technology people talk about. They're talking about different projects. They're talking about the things that people do. They're not talking about a test or a great chapter or a great lecture, except for the very short TED Talk. So anyway, thank you all for helping record this. It's just been a very excellent conversation. Back over to Julie.
Some final thoughts from me. I mean, in the summary of this chapter on page 193, we actually quote the quote that I think everyone knows. Albert Einstein says, "I never teach my pupils, I only provide the conditions in which they can learn." I think that really sums up what we're trying to contribute in this particular chapter. And really, you know, hearing people talk during this slight past hour, you know, I think we've, for myself in particular, I've just really scratched the surface in terms of my own understanding of differentiation and this whole topic. And I think like Tina was saying, she's got a whole summer project. I think that will be my summer project too, to try and extend this further and just get a deeper understanding of it. But you know, I think it's such an important chapter, such an important part of what we do in the Slack classroom, and such an important thing, part of what every teacher should be looking at as well. Thanks again. Back to you.
Thanks, Julie. Thanks, Vicki. And thanks to everybody for joining in today. I really appreciate your time. Great conversation. And we'll see you next time, Sunday the 29th, 6 p.m. Eastern. We're talking Chapter 8. Take care, everybody.